This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
This afternoon we've got, of course, the topic is writing onto the public record our stories. Now, again, that came from, if you recall, from the Vox Populi we showed you, Wesley Enochs, one of his things. This is very integrated with the exhibition and what people have said about this topic of the urban Aborigine. And so we have the speakers, you can see on your program, Andy Greenslade is chair. Andy was and has been for some time a curator in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander program here at the National Museum, involved with a lot of the early exhibits and most recently the Urnabella one she's worked on, and the urban, she's worked on the urban, 70% urban with myself and Barbara. And she will take over from me and run through the another fabulous, highly textured group of people.
Glad you stayed. I'm sure you don't really need me to introduce Peter because we've already heard, but we'll run through anyway. Visiting professorial fellow in the Department of History in the University of Sydney. Fortunately, we get to use him for quite a few of our things. We have In Contact, author of The Stolen Generations and Charles Perkins, a biography, currently researching a biography of Joy Janica Williams and a history of Aboriginal Sydney.
At the moment, I feel like a television series where different parts of me are so diverse. I've got a political background, I've got a musical background, I've got an academic background, I've got a homeless person's background, I've got an alcoholic woman's background, I've got a lot of other strong backgrounds. Somehow these things have to come together. Even when I die, it's still going to be a bit of a jigsaw puzzle. Someday someone will work out what it's all supposed to be, because I've got no idea myself. Well, my earliest memories would have been with a lady with a silver buckle visiting me at Bomaderry. I think now that probably she was my mother, going from Bomaderry to Lutanda, that's the home I went second, with Sister Saville and Auntie Leela. I remember a station at Strathfield had its hedges all cut into animal shapes. I can remember having bread and milk when we got to Lutanda as well. I was wearing a little tartan skirt and a little blue coat. I remember that. Now, I was never told of any decision not to send me to the Cootamundra Girls' Home as I got older, but obviously there was a decision taken. Years ago, I wrote to Lutanda and asked them why I went there. And they sent me back this certificate that was made at the time. I showed it to Mum, and she'd signed it, but she told me that it didn't have anything written on it when she signed it. That was in 1947. It said something like, reason for admission to take the child away from Association of Aborigines as she is a fair-skinned child. That's why I didn't go to Kuta. Religion, very important. We had plenty of that. Many were chosen, but few would go. It's in the Bible anyway. I've been sometimes awake until my eyes got dry because I was so frightened I wouldn't be taken. We weren't allowed to put another book on top of the Bible, literally. Otherwise, we were told God couldn't see his written word. I used to think, God, there's so many bloody Bibles around. Why can't you find somewhere else to look at one? Sundays, church in the morning, Sunday school in the afternoon, the older girls and boys went to church at night. During the week, we always had to say our prayers and say grace, even if we didn't like what it was for dinner. Ironic that, eh? Having to say thanks for the dinner we hated. I didn't do too well at school, never did really well. After school, it was jobs, cleaning shoes, helping put ironing away that the ladies had come in and done every Tuesday, ladies from the church, Saturdays too, and we had a roster that filled every day of the week, and they couldn't have run the home without the children doing the work. Don't remember much about my childhood. I was a lonely child. The aloneness. I had to find myself a hiding spot in the children's home so I could have a place of my own. It was right up in the corner of a big paddock, and I wouldn't let anybody else come in. I didn't make a cubby house, but I could see them come to me. Bit sad, isn't it? The kids used to get food and lollies from their visitors, so I punched the girls out if they didn't give it to me or share it with me. But nobody ever told me about me mum. And at Christmas, I was the only one left. Lutanda, in its answer to me in court, said that's not true. I can't remember anyone else staying over Christmas. They said how stable the lifestyle and everything was. But we weren't treated like individuals. If there was any trouble going on, they'd always assume I was in the middle of it. But I don't know how much trouble I really caused. I was probably a bit aggressive because I was unhappy, especially when I found out I had a mother. Once I was taken to a Sunday school picnic to La Perouse, and all the young Koori boys were diving in for money. How could they do such a thing? I'm glad I'm not like one of them. Jesus Christ! We wouldn't even consider doing things like that. I wasn't better than them, but I thought I was. I'd been made to think I was. I think I was about 12, and that's when I started waiting for Mum on visiting days. It was one of the workers. One of the staff told me I actually had a mother. I always had thought I was an orphan. I knew I had a horrible origin. I can only put it, as I see things now, that I thought at that stage everything had been done for me that possibly could have been done. But no, no. There was one more thing, and even now there'll always be one more thing that somebody else can do. I was in high school. I'd done something wrong. And this woman said to me, well, you know you're Aboriginal, don't you? And your mother didn't want you, and there's mud in your veins, and by the way, she was a drunk. I didn't even know what a drunk was. It was up in her room. I was standing up, and she was looking down to me. Horrible woman! I was devastated. Absolutely devastated. I hardly knew what Aboriginal was, but I soon found out in history lessons. We did ancient history, of course, so the Koori's came into the Stone Age. And the only Koori I'd ever heard of was Albert Namajira. I remember the bloody mission place that used to go round for the poor little black fella. And I was in so much trouble and isolation at the children's home at the time. I had nowhere to go. Nowhere. Look at the cuts in my arms. I started doing that when I wanted to find out what colour my blood was and was running away from home as well. I think I wanted to have some mark on me that I was somebody and that I belonged to somebody. I was a loner, very much so, and the other girls were probably a little bit frightened of me. I was always aggressive. I had to be on top, but nobody wanted me, except to work. I was looking after the girls all the time when I was 16. Now, I grew up thinking I was ugly and stupid. I didn't do well at school, never did really well. I don't think anyone wanted me, and I was angry most of the time, always attention-seeking, whether it was good or bad. That's why I was converted a lot, so many times, because they were all over you like a rash when you're converted. I don't remember a lot what happened as a child, and when I do remember things, I have to sort it out whether it's a fantasy memory that kept me surviving. I don't deliberately or maliciously lie. I hate lightning. Lightning, I know when it's going to come. It's like a belt being held up. You know it's going to come cracking down, and you just freeze with the crack, if you know what I mean. And, you know, it's going to hit. But it was incredible going up those wooden stairs because this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. And use the bloody belt. And, you know, at times at Lutanda, I used to pray like mad that it wouldn't hurt them like they said it was going to. And they're kind of talking to you with one arm on your shoulder, like a claw. And then it'd come the lightning. Thunder, not so much. Lightning terrifies me, equivalent to Armageddon. And the fear. The fear. I never did well at school, not real well. I got the intermediate, I think. No, I didn't. I only got English. I didn't care. I didn't even know what it meant, but it certainly limited my opportunities for employment at Hornsby Girls High. Running away, I guess that was attention getting too. It was very easy to run away. One time I didn't go back for two nights because I was too frightened. I slept on Hornsby Station and I spent a night with this fella. Nothing happened, though. Next thing, they hauled me down to the cop shop at Hornsby, where they gave me an internal. And I was still a virgin, much to their surprise. But when I got back to the home, I got a hiding with a butter pat, and I had to write out 500 times. After I left school, I worked on at Lutanda. They never paid me. I used to do the same work as any of the workers. Didn't like it much, but they got me a job in the city at a bike shop. I wasn't there very long. That's where they got me the job at Parramatta District as a nurse's aide. The majority of girls went into business college, nurse's aide, and I think that was from Lutanda because we were never allowed to wear makeup. And we had our faces scrubbed by Lutanda staff if we ever did. It was a Plymouth Brethren home. I was living in, and that was when my connection with Lutanda stopped. They said I couldn't go back anymore, even on my days off, because I didn't live there. The superintendent told me that. He was a horrible man, horrible. I think I was a troublemaker, and they saw me as a troublemaker. No, Joy, you can't come back here. You live at the nurse's quarters now, and that's where you stay. But, you know, it was there that I was introduced to drugs from one of the senior nurses. First of all, they gave me amphetamines to keep me awake. I asked her what it was for, and she said, methadrine, and I liked the feel of that. Then I was getting sleeping pills at night. Carbitol. I was a junkie. First to make me wake up, and then someone to put me to sleep. On weekends, I'd go out with blokes, usually visitors I'd meet. Some of them were good times. I didn't like being the victim of rape, though, and that happened quite a lot. I had no ideas of the ways of the world, no idea at all. And I started going to the cross as well. Ambitions, well, I wanted it all at once. I wanted to be a nurse, but I didn't know the hard work and the preparation that went into it. I had no idea what I was capable of doing. I had to learn survival skills, to learn the sense of paying board and lodging at the place where I was working. And I never could understand why I had to pay rent if I was working there. I imagined myself as a mother with a husband and three children. That didn't work out, did it? So one day I just left. It was one of my days off and I just didn't go back. By then I was sitting pretty much in the routine of the cross. I was there more often than I was at home, at work. I used to go there with some of the nurses. I think I started that just for the night if one of them was having a birthday. And the cross was the place that one of the superintendents told me, you must never, never, never go there. I wondered why, because we were always told to lay ourselves at the foot of the cross. And here's the bloody cross. The first night, I remembered it vaguely. We first met in the coffee lounge, Apollyon, I think it was called. A dentist and his wife used to run it. And they let us sit there for hours and hours and hours, just one cup of coffee. Sometimes I do the washing up, or at least I get enough for feminine items and access to a dentist. Sometimes I used to go into that little coffee shop, hooked on amphetamines, not on alcohol. I didn't drink. As first from the hospital, and then I got the pills from the truckies. The truckies used to go to that coffee shop too. And at Central Railway Station, we could go and wash and dry our hair. So I was living at the cross, homeless most of the time. Flop houses and so on. That's where I met Koori women. Flop houses, sixpence a night, nothing. Depends on who had the money. A little group of us would sleep on the floors. And girls and boys, all homeless, long before the cross became a drug centre or bus stops. I remember I used to sleep at the Darlinghurst fire station. Rape was the order of the day usually too. When I used to pick up blokes for a room for the night, that's all it was for. You couldn't say no. Pretty bad memories? Yeah, they are. Very traumatic memories. Actually, it's something I haven't talked about before. Even the relationships I've been in, every one of them have all been violent, except for one. I remember the Vice Squad and the Vagrancy Act. I'd pick up somebody and get a room for the night, and then the Dawn Patrol would come through, and not only the woman was arrested and charged with indecent behaviour. Aboriginality, no. Not very strong. I knew I was a Koori, but the Wayside Chapel, I met up with Charlie Perkins and Cole Hardy, and I was on the phone system for the Freedom Ride. Not only with nowhere to go, but no prospect of going anywhere either. I used to take a lot of methadrine and stuff like that from the truckies. You never feel hungry with that. Not much use getting hungry either. The way I used to have me bath was to go swimming in the baths at Woolloomooloo. I used to do my washing there too. It was all the underwear I had. Not anything to speak of. Prostitution hadn't occurred to me then. Lutanda had written me off as a bad girl. So, very much unloved. Although, I felt I belonged to this particular group. I have a very, very deep sense of abandonment. Friends have too, especially when they moved away. Jail, well, that was worse than North Ryde Mental Hospital, I think. Never got any sleeping tablets. Ray Desmond was there, and he was from Broken Hill. And Bill Cruz, this is before the Wayside Chapel started. I spent 7 days at Long Bay. That never worried me. I was already institutionalised, so a jail couldn't hurt me. And I used to go down to the Domain on Sundays, where I learnt my public speaking. Talk up with the best of them. That's where I was introduced to the Communist Party as well. Or I'd go to poetry readings or Bohemia. Or that pub down there at Pyrmont, the Royal George, I was writing too. And there was a poem I wrote there, I think it was called Shadows, the very first poem I wrote. Drinking? Yeah. I think I was just getting into drinking then. In the beginning, it was just the cherries on a Pimm's, no more than that. And I was in jail for 8 months. On my record, it's only got twice, but I think it was more than that. For vagrancy, 7 days or until the fine was paid. And Auntie Nago, that's Mrs. Ingram, told me about my Aboriginality, and that's, I think, she introduced me to the foundation, you know, that place down in George Street, a welfare and Aboriginal drop-in centre, George Street. And I stayed at Enmore with her for a while, and that introduced me to Koorees. Identifying as a Koorie, oh yeah, in a kind of a way, but as a parkie, I was a park Aboriginal, that was all I knew. Maybe Social Security put me on a social worker on the Anglican thing and put me into TAFE when I was doing graphic art for a while, but I also was homeless, so it was impossible to continue. And the social worker told me to go to the foundation. You know, half my relatives from Cowra were in the foundation. I didn't know a single one of them. It made me feel more non-accepted by the white community because I started hanging out with Koorees. And the Cross used to be a good place to live. It was obvious I wasn't going to make it as a nurse's aide. I wasn't studying, missing work, always under the eye of somebody, and then I shot through. But it was awful being homeless. The best thing that happened to me was when they brought in the hand dryer there so we could dry our hair. I'd finished jail, nowhere to go, and my parole officer put me into North Ryde Mental Hospital. We were in pyjamas for 7 days, and they worked out our medication. They tried different things like stilazine, melcidin, triptanol, tofranol, largactyl, good old largactyl, mogadons, barbiturates. I was there for 2 or 3 months at a time. Wasn't too bad, another institution, but that's when the medication really started. I was in North Ryde for periods up to 3 months, about 4 times, uncontrollable. Though a couple of times they said, why the hell is she here? Then you were allowed weekend leave, and I used to chuff off down to the city. And then there was group therapy. You're supposed to talk about your innermost feeling. You seem to sit in a big circle. I know it now as confrontation therapy. You sit in a big circle, and if you said you felt good, they'd keep at you till you felt rotten. You had to work it out yourself, and if you didn't, the psychiatrist would spout it out. I was still very much a child, the child I never was. I was 19. A refugee, yeah, it was. But the place was a refuge, and it didn't worry me that there was a psych hospital. One time the superintendent from Lutanda came over when I was in group therapy at Fraser House. He left in disgust. Why? Because it was Pick on Joy Day. And the psychiatrist told him what I'd been in jail for. Still religious. It irritates me how I was treated. I don't want to talk about that anymore. But I had a baby, my Julianne. And somehow, I lost her. They were put into St. Anthony's Baby's Home, and they told me she was sick. I don't know whether she was sick or not. She would have been 6 or 7 months when I just lobbed in to see her at Croydon, and I nearly died when I saw there were nuns there, not again. I went back to try and see her the second time, and the nuns told me she was sick. And when I went back the third time, she was gone. They reckon I'd signed papers, apparently, and they had with me at North Ryde. Maybe a couple of months later I took off again, apparently. I'd taken off from North Ryde, and when I came back, they got a male nurse to take me over to St. Anthony's to sign the adoption papers. I'm told that I signed them because I was very heavily sedated. What did I sign? I was on 600 mils of largactyl a day. Should have killed an elephant. Even now I can't handle babies crying. My Julianne. So I was working at a place called George Street where they sold men's clothes real cheap. And I had a lot of good jobs, mainly part-time. Not for too long, though, because I knew there were little rooms you could rent. And got good feed there. Sydney Folk Club, Gary Shearston, Declan Affley, Marion Henderson. I stayed on at the chapel. Looking for work. Went to Melbourne quite a few times. Went to Adelaide. Still had a lot of work to do with white people. Always looking for my mum and never finding her. When I went hitching, I was looking for my mum. All I knew about my mum was she did grape and bean picking, and I knew her name because it was on my birth certificate. But I didn't know if my mother had told anyone she'd even had a baby. I ended up in Nowra years later. Nobody knew she'd even had me at all. Casual work, yeah. I was always trying to get work, but no one would believe me that I wanted it. I didn't like men at the time because, well, they could do so much damage. I saw them as violent. Even sex was violent, a violent act, because I'd been raped so many bloody times. Never went to the police. I did once, and they wouldn't believe me. Removed child, here I am. The part you never get back is the missing that you've done all the years, what you missed out on. There's nothing there can put it back, even with Julianne. Just because I had three children, what's a mother anyway, for God's sake? You know, on sorry day, someone had to point out there's more than one stolen generation. There's three in my family, for a start. That's disgusting. I can't think that anything makes up for that loss. And it's still a loss. Thanks.
Thanks, Peter, for telling that really heart-wrenching story, and one of so many. I'd now like to introduce Michael Aird. Graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in Anthropology from the University of Queensland. Main interest is urban Aboriginal photographic history. Worked in the area of Aboriginal culture and heritage for over 20 years, and in that time curated several exhibitions as well as publishing books and articles. For 5 years, Michael was curator of Aboriginal Studies at Queensland Museum and is currently the director of Aboriginal-owned publishing house Kiara Press. Thanks, Mark.
I'll just go down, it'll be mine, I think. Thanks, Andy. I don't know which mic I'm speaking. I'll speak. Okay, I'll get rid of that one then. Okay. I've got a paper here that I'll read. I'll start. The early 1980s was a time when urban Aboriginal people increasingly publicly voiced their concerns as to how their culture and history was being portrayed by institutions. I guess that's why I'm showing this first photo, because I have to give credit. I mean, in reference to myself, one of those people in the 80s that joined the area, but of course, as I mentioned with Bronwyn this morning and plenty of others that were there long before us doing things. And Stephen's talked about the work his father was doing representing Aboriginal people in various levels. So I have to give credit to those people that were there long before us. And they're the ones that were out in the street. They're the ones that have fought. They're the ones that made it possible for us to secure careers and be in places like this today talking. It was the intense political struggle of the previous decades that opened the doors for a new generation of Aboriginal people that wanted to do more than protest, but secure careers as professionals in the arts and cultural heritage industry. One of the first institutions to be attacked in the 1980s was museums and non-Aboriginal curators that controlled the Aboriginal collections. There was a dream held by many Aboriginal communities at the time that was for the government to fund the building of keeping places and cultural centres, and the government institutions would then return the artefacts from each local region to community control. This paper will discuss proposed community museum projects that never eventuated, as well as look at buildings that were actually established and discuss how successful or not they have been. I commenced my career in Aboriginal cultural heritage in June 1985, working for Dr. Peter Lauer at the University of Queensland Anthropology Museum. I was carrying out research in archaeological sites to be nominated on the National Estate. This work was intended to contribute to the establishment of an Aboriginal cultural centre to be built on the Gold Coast. At the time, it was anticipated that a multi-million dollar bicentennial grant would fund the construction of this building. The large bucket of funding never eventuated and the building was never built. In retrospect, it would have never succeeded, even if several millions of controversial grant money, as a lot of Aboriginal groups were objecting the whole concept of receiving bicentennial money. The concept was far too ambitious and it would never have been able to compete with the big name tourist attractions such as Dreamworld, SeaWorld and Movie World. Numerous market studies talk of overseas tourists wanting an Aboriginal experience while in Australia, although nobody really knows what sort of experience they expect. And there doesn't seem to be any accurate exit polls to determine how many tourists actually got the Aboriginal experience that they hoped for. But one thing that was identified in the market studies done in the 1980s and supported by more recent research is that tourists are not going to part with their hard-earned cash to hear about Aboriginal culture from fair-skinned Aborigines living in an urbanised area such as the Gold Coast. Those that are interested in Aboriginal culture will save their money for a genuine Aboriginal experience at places such as at places where there are, quotation marks, real Aborigines, such as Cairns or Alice Springs. The reality of the market is that the big tourist attractions do such a good job of extracting money out of the tourists. There is only a very small demographic left that can afford to or may want to visit an Aboriginal tourist attraction. And of course, they are most likely interested in an Aboriginal experience that fits in with their own preconceived ideas as to what genuine Aboriginal culture is. For example, red loincloths, a didgeridoo, and of course, dark-skinned Aborigines. Sorry, forgot the... This is the slide of the proposed cultural centre that was never built. You can see in the foreground, actually, a Bora ring. It was on a very small block of land. That's the Pacific Highway going past. And a lot of people questioned, how could you fit such a big building on such a small block of land right beside a sacred site? So I think a lot of people are glad that it never got built. And then also, if the building failed, how could you then on-sell it to some other purpose if it's right on a sacred ceremonial site? This essentially sums up the obstacles that have faced Aboriginal communities all over Australia that have attempted to establish museums or cultural centres with the dream of becoming self-sufficient thanks to the tourist dollar. Part and parcel of this whole process has been the army of government officials that have promised funding to Aboriginal communities to set up museums and keeping places as long as they can prove that they will be financially viable. And I'm convinced that the only way to prove that any proposed cultural institution will be financially viable is to use some form of totally made up and dishonest accounting system. And I think you'll find, of course, this building in itself couldn't survive without extra funding. As in a sense, it's not viable. I'm proud to say that the second Aboriginal cultural project that I was involved in was actually built, and almost 20 years later is still operating successfully. In 1987, I was employed by the Brisbane Catholic Education Office to develop plans for an Aboriginal cultural centre to service the educational needs of the entire Brisbane Diocese, which covers much of southeast Queensland. This was intended as the Catholic Church's contribution to the bicentennial year, along with a promise to fund the upkeep of the building and two staff indefinitely. The difference between this cultural centre and so many other proposed cultural centre projects of the 1980s was that this project did not get out of hand with false promises and grand plans. In other words, we were told, OK, picture two classrooms put together, placed on the edge of a school oval, that's how big it will be. Now, what is the best way to turn this into a functional Aboriginal cultural centre? Now, this building, that's an old friend of mine, Arthur Peterson, there when couldn't believe it, within 12 months this building was actually starting to be constructed. And that's the building when it was first built. It's actually been extended and quite a lot looks a lot better than that again today. This building was opened in 1988, which is pretty good as the planning for it only began the year before. Almost 20 years later, it is far more substantial than two classrooms put together, and the church is sold off the oval where this photo was taken, which was an important part. They could take the kids out and throw boomerangs on this oval. The church has actually sold off the oval and built units on it, but everything came together, working with the financial realities of the time and slowly building on it. And I think one of the main reasons that that it was successful is that it was built in the highly urbanised, mainly housing commission suburb of Inala, one of the most outlying and disadvantaged suburbs of Brisbane. Here we had a strong Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community that were willing to claim this building as their own and contribute to it. Here's Rosemary Bell, Richard's sister-in-law. She was Rosemary Graham back then, but she spent her whole life growing up in Inala, and she ends up, director of this centre. And she brought in all the community that she knew well, and they all helped. So, 19 years surviving. The Catholic Church, in this case, has stuck to its promise and kept on funding and building up. And they're on a bit of a creek, which is now a beautiful sort of cultural walk. Okay, in 1995, I took up the position as curator of Aboriginal Studies at the Queen's Museum, a position I held for 5 years. In my time at the museum, I came into contact with community representatives from all over Queensland that wanted to build cultural centres. Well, by this time, terms such as community museums and keeping places were being used. By the 1990s, things had changed a bit. People had realised that the multi-million dollar buckets of money that people were promised in the 1980s were never going to eventuate, and expectations were far more realistic. In fact, some communities had built up fantastic resources relying on volunteer labour of old people and the occasional small grants of a few thousand dollars. And another reason several communities succeeded in documenting much of their history and physically protecting this information was that they built genuine relationships with local institutions or government people that could help them in some way. I can name examples of school teachers, clergy, librarians, local aldermen, amateur historians, and many others that shared their expertise and supported Aboriginal communities secure much-needed basic resources to carry out important cultural work. In my opinion, the most successful community museum projects have been those that have ignored the promises of lots of money from government people and simply moved ahead with whatever resources they could secure. This is a picture of Irene Ryder at the Mitchell Yumba. She found where this is the old school that used to be on the Yumba, and Stephen, I know the story well, similar to Cunnamulla, where they had a thriving fringe camp, the school, and then they removed the school and made all the people move into town, and I think, but the people still had fond memories of that place, and they put the school, sort of took charge of the land where the Yumba used to be, put the old school building back, and that little building then became the cultural centre. I don't know what the museum professionals think of the signage, but it's pretty interesting. And those signs are all over the place, and you know, talking about where different families had their camps and whatever. And so it's just Irene's just a classic example of somebody who has just attacked and harassed people and just screwed whoever could help in some way. She's just done it, and she's done an incredible amount of cultural work and supported by others in the community. It's not just her doing the work. Okay, in the early 1990s, members of my own community established a small museum in a rented building in an industrial area in a cheaply constructed block brick building that was first built as a church and later used as a cabinet making factory. It is called the Yugambeh Museum Language and Heritage Centre. Its establishment was clearly a result of the dream that was first ignited when the multi-million dollar tourist attraction was proposed, but on a far more realistic scale. And far from the central tourism precinct of the Gold Coast. The locality itself has caused some confusion, as it was situated in Beenleigh, the most northern suburb of the Gold Coast. In fact, many people from the Gold Coast do not even consider Beenleigh to be part of the Gold Coast. But the location was central to a few staff that initially worked in the building, but it was not central or easy to get to for most of the community members or potential visitors. In fact, I've heard a lot of people say there should be an Aboriginal museum on the Gold Coast, and I say there is one, it's at Beenleigh. They say, yeah, but there should be one on the Gold Coast. In its first few years, the museum produced a few exhibitions with well-attended openings and catered for numerous school and community groups. Although in recent years the school visits have ceased and the numbers of community groups and researchers have dropped off, and the sign in front of the building stating that it is a museum has been removed. And you're actually looking at the front entrance of the building. I didn't purposely try and take a horrible photo of it, but it doesn't look welcoming at all. In 2006, the community organisation that administers the museum changed its constitution to restrict its potential membership to one family group. But some members of that family group that have tried to join the organisation have been rejected without explanation. The need to explain rejections was also removed from the constitution in 2006. And I'm not criticising some other family that I'm related to. It's actually my close relatives that have changed the rules to exclude me and my brother and my mother and whoever else. Even though the museum and land has been purchased by the Indigenous Land Corporation and it continues to receive federal funding, it raises the question. Is a community museum, if the community are excluded from the building and its operation? I'm sure many other communities have asked this question. Another building, this was actually a community group out the back of Rockhampton, between Rockhampton and Woorabinda, who wanted to set up a a museum. They were doing a lot of archaeological work with coal mines, whatever, in the area. They bought a cattle property. This was a house on the property. And they had plans of turning this into a cultural sort of archaeological research centre, a place they could take visitors. But it was a dream, but I don't think it really happened. And then, and here's another sad photo, one of the most important collections of Aboriginal art put together by Aboriginal community, I guess, in a sense, the first really successful community-run cultural centre in Queensland would have been the Opal Centre, which, Barbara, you know that well. They put together an incredible collection of Aboriginal art. They were helping promote the Aboriginal arts industry, keeping a lot of the good art. Some very well-known artists had their work in this building, Ron Hurley, Kath Walker, many others. And Multiplex were building the building next door, and they were underscoring the footings of the building. I think it was a Friday afternoon, about 3 o'clock, and the builders raced in and said, "Everybody out of the building, it's going to collapse." And it collapsed with an incredibly valuable collection in it. And they went back in and tried to get some of the collection. Here's some of it. So, I mean, advice, somehow you need to... you can't plan for things like that. But they're all collections that need to be protected somehow. Here's another building, another group of community people at Milmerran, involved with a mining power station, coal mine mount power station project. They were promised, they asked for a cultural centre, as most Aboriginal groups do. They said, "Oh, well, here's a house on one of the properties we own. We'll turn that into an Aboriginal cultural centre." The community group said, "That's great." I was called in to, as a museum professional, to try and advise how to turn this house into a functional museum. We took away a couple of walls between bedrooms, set up shelving systems, good ventilation, security. A full office was established. Cabinets, good quality cabinets, good lighting was put in, full boardroom workshop area. And I think what some of the things people were talking about ticking lots of money and ticking boxes and committees, gatekeeping, and this beautiful museum, well, functional little museum was set up. But once the money from the mining company stopped coming in, because basically it was handed over to the community and said, "Here's your building, we'll pay the electricity and basic maintenance, but we're not paying anybody wages, it's your building, turn it into a practical museum," and that was the end of that. I think the community people involved had moved on to the next pot of money, and the building basically hasn't been used. So, Milmerran, Darling Downs. So it's sort of a great project to be involved in, but just sort of sad that so many communities would love a resource like that, but it hasn't worked. Because the people involved were, I think, committed more to money coming in from mining companies rather than actually running museums with little pay. So in my role as curator at the Queen's Museum, and more recently as a consultant, I have been invited to several workshops held by communities considering establishing museums. On these occasions, I made a point of challenging all involved to think of the future. Firstly, I would say that the only way a community museum would be successful is if a lot of people contributed a lot of effort, mostly without pay. Secondly, I would say that people have to contribute their knowledge, their stories, their family photographs or other precious items. Then I would warn them, once they have contributed so much, they could be overthrown by a bunch of dishonest ratbags at the next AGM, excluded from the building, and someone else would then control their history and everything they contributed. So I would warn them, before they give anything up, weigh up the risks and then choose carefully what and how much they contribute, and if things turn sour, they should be prepared and not go to their graves bitter and twisted. I actually offended numerous people talking like this, and they would angrily say back to me, "There are no ratbags in our community, only us, only good people." Of course, I would say, "I'm only talking in theory and not suggesting it's true, although I wish I could say there were no dishonest ratbags in my own family." Possibly the failure of many community museums, that they end up being controlled by only a few individuals and totally dependent on government funding instead of growing as a community organisation and bringing in people that can help them grow. They do the opposite. They close ranks and see all others as just wanting to steal their knowledge and, more importantly, take their funding. In the real world of business, there really is such a thing as an ever-increasing pie. For example, if you own a bookshop and another bookshop opens next door, that may actually be good for business. If you end up in a street that has 5 or 6 bookshops, then lots of people will go there to buy books. Same with restaurants. People will go to a street that has a lot of restaurants rather than go to an isolated restaurant and find that it is full or closed and their night is a disaster. Aboriginal history and culture should be the same. If one community group can do a great job documenting and presenting their history, then this should create the interest and opportunity for others in the community to do the same. Here's a photo of the Kalkadoon Centre in Mount Isa. It's been open since, I think, early 80s, I think it opened. It was an incredible sort of structure of a building. They tried to build out a Besser block, tried to construct it like a snake, but it only got one little bit of the snake. It's supposed to keep on going as they got more funding. And they had an incredible collection of local art. But then over the years, this museum just sort of deteriorated. I'm showing you the after shots after me and a designer that I work with sometimes actually went there and did it up. I didn't want to embarrass the community by showing this before shots because they weren't real good. I mean, yeah, finding things like dead birds and great big dead lizards, you know, behind cabinets and stuff was... And even James Cook University returned some, you know, sort of 100-year-old wooden shields and they got placed right on the floor in the main walkway. And there was a lot of cupboards with nothing in them, but they didn't make it into the cupboard. But, yeah, we did this museum up and it, you know, a $10 million government-funded building got built beside them. So that gave this building a huge boost. In fact, at least the state government and council put up $20,000 to get this building really fixed up. So here's just a few shots of what it looks and it's no comparison to what it looked like before. Now, this is actually this time last week. I was working up where this building is at Cherbourg, the Aboriginal community, about 3 hours' drive north of Brisbane. And this is a great story of how a lot of the good people in that community got together. They found the old ration shed, which obviously the building where they used to get when they were young, the rations would be handed out. They found it, I don't know, way down one bottom of the community paddock somewhere behind another council yard or something, and they got it and put it right back close to where it used to be. And put a big rock. Everybody's got to have a rock to document special events, and decked it out inside with a display, lots of photos, a bit too many photos for one room. If I had to show you a 360 degree, there's just photos in every angle, all the same size. It was curated by a librarian, so I sort of do doubt librarians' display skills sometimes. They might have other skills. 1 minute, okay. That's just another museum project. Yeah, so I hope you don't think I'm off on a tangent discussing economics rather than urban Aboriginal history. But my point is that we all know that there is a perception that nobody is interested in urban Aboriginal history and that so-called traditional Aboriginal history is far more interesting and marketable. So how can we turn this misperception around? A sad reality in Queensland is emerging that one of the most viable models is to be able to fund Aboriginal cultural heritage projects. I'd be able to fund Aboriginal culture is to incorporate these projects with a native title claim. Essentially, the Queensland government has begun to completely ignore the cultural heritage aspirations of Aboriginal communities unless they have a recognised Indigenous land use agreement or registered native title claim. While at the same time, the government is doing everything it can to prevent Aboriginal communities from registering their native title claims. Here's some people discussing native title. To have a successful native claim, a community must carry out extensive and accurate research that is done to such a high standard that it can stand up in court against well-funded government legal teams. In the long term, communities will benefit from this research, but not all are happy with this. For many years, inaccurate versions of Aboriginal history have been promoted that have fitted in with the stereotypical expectations of tourists, the mainstream media, and in particular government officials. Some of these inaccurate histories have promoted mythical tribes that in turn have elevated the status of a few individuals or one family group. Sadly, some Aboriginal people do not want any native title research to be carried out in their region, as they are scared that well-researched facts may conflict with the inaccurate versions of history that they have promoted for and benefited from for many years. Here's a group of protesters having trouble. This is with the Tjugan Bypass and the Gold Coast Tweed. I'll just give one more paragraph. literally getting opposed by Aboriginal people and in a situation where they have to protest just to try and get in the door. And there's, I don't want to name any names, but there's a couple of consultants that came in and pretty much screwed the community and got paid lots of money and no decent work got carried out. So sort of sad to say that I start the talk with protesting and sort of finish it now with protesting. As professionals in the cultural heritage industry, it is our responsibility to accurately document and present Aboriginal history and all its complexities in an interesting and exciting way that so that all Australians and the rest of the world will want to hear our story, and in turn resources, either commercial or from the government, will be secured to enable this to be done.
Thanks, Michael. Obviously hard yards to go and a lot of cooperation needed, but when you see some of the successful models, you know they're really worth the effort.
Photo. This is a, now it's up here, this is a photo of, this is why I was up before supporting 98.9, the Brisbane Indigenous Media Association, because I'm on their board. I went to a meeting a few months ago with the whole staff and the board, and it's just incredible. I've mentioned a few times today, you know, for me, 20 years ago, I had a dream of securing a career in Aboriginal cultural heritage, and for people before me, it was even harder than that again. These young kids are going straight from school, getting jobs at a place like a radio station in the cultural heritage. They're accepting it as just the norm. I want to work in Aboriginal radio. I can. It's incredible to see this organisation with 27 full-time staff offering real hope to kids where it's not a dream now. It's just a career choice.
Yeah. I think the same experience is over in Broome with Gulari. They run their own training programs. Run the same training programs, and it's absolutely the business to be in. Earlier on this afternoon, Stephen made some comment about academics maintaining the status quo and things wouldn't change. Well, we've heard from one academic this afternoon, and I'd like to welcome the second, Christine Hansen. Christine is a doctoral candidate at ANU for Indigenous History in Australia at the ANU. Currently the ARC Linkage Scholar on the project Australian Indigenous Collectors and Collections, which is being conducted in partnership with the NMA. So, Christine, please.
So, I've been thinking, what an amazing forum. I'm just going to speak on a very small scale now about the work that I've been doing as a white fellow working in a museum in ways that interact with the Indigenous collection. Really it doesn't in many ways address the sort of broad range of the conversation that's been going on today, which has been absolutely incredible, completely fantastic forum. So this is really about this institution, the National Museum. So when people in Australia are asked to rank sources of information about the past that they most trust, museums come close to the top of the poll, and this is actually from a survey, well ahead of history teachers and far ahead of politicians, unsurprisingly, who come last. That may be because, I think, museums are custodians of the public record held in 3D, in stuff, in objects. Stuff is fun. Old stuff in particular is compelling. There's something about objects that speaks to us directly. Things stand as witness to a human past, evidence which substantiates particular narratives. Of course, when placed in the context of a national museum, as they are here, objects collectively participate in constructing the larger narrative of nation.
The inaugural director of the NMA, Dawn Casey, had no qualms in admitting that Australia's National Museum, like others of its era, is a consciously nation-building exercise. Now, inside this nation-building exercise, as we all are at the moment, the museum must navigate a path to find appropriate Indigenous cultural representation, albeit within the totalising concepts of national identity and national history, which is a really, really tricky thing to do. If the objects in the collection of the NMA narrate the nation, which is what the proposal is, then that narrative includes stories by and about Aboriginal people. More than includes, depends on. Aboriginal material culture, in fact, has been absolutely central to the entire notion of the museum in Australia since Henry Parkes first mooted the idea of a what he called memorial state house in 1887, but it was the idea of a museum. His suggestion was that such an institution should contain, amongst other things, and this is from a letter that he wrote to, some colonial bigwig back home, relics as may be illustrative of the various Aboriginal races of Australia, their customs, languages and ethnological characteristics. So that was the idea right back in 1887, and so it came to be. Not within his term of administration, but over the next half a century, swarms of ethnographers, anthropologists and collectors, many, as we know from the shady side of the track, went out into the field to gather and bring back to the academy examples, and when I say examples, I mean truckloads, of Aboriginal material culture. Much of this material sits in storehouses here in Canberra, and even today still dominates the National Historical Collection, of which this museum is the custodian, which really surprised me when I found that out. It's through these vast collections that that museums in general, in Australia and overseas, particularly in Europe, have had a heavy hand in defining what Aboriginality is and how it should look in the popular imagination. This is the place where people come to find out about Aborigines. They are deeply implicated in describing the taxonomies from which the trope of the primitive, the traditional, the authentic, or whatever the language of the day prescribes is constructed. Of course, we no longer see the types of narratives that were found in museum exhibits of the past. The dioramas showing the lifestyles of hunter-gatherers, the glass cases of implements disconnected from their makers and locations, and behind the scenes, the drawers and cupboards of human remains. Dawn Casey, who, as we all know, herself is an Indigenous person, has quite bluntly stated that the dates when museums could collect and display ethnographic material from the viewpoint of a dominant culture depicting an exotic minority culture are well and truly over. It goes without saying that Indigenous narratives told through exhibitions here and elsewhere have been reimagined within a more sensitive contemporary context, mostly by Indigenous curators such as Michael, Barbie, Margot, and community participants. So you'd think that would be the end of the story, wouldn't you? We've got that one sorted. If nothing else, we've got that worked out. Well, I thought so too, until it was my turn as a researcher to venture out into the field. My research area was to be, and in fact is, the south coast of New South Wales. And as a beginning point, thinking to consult the wisdom of experience, I arranged to speak with a senior research advisor here at the museum. I started off by telling him about my project, but within the first couple of sentences, I noticed him glazing over. The South Coast held no interest for him. The people of southeastern Australia, he told me, had no distinctive material culture. Decimated by the colonising process, their possessions would reflect merely their diminished cultural status. Sadly, he noticed this was true for all Aboriginal people this side of the frontier. The frontier, he said, could be drawn on a map as a line that stretched approximately from Townsville to Perth. As I was about to discover, he said, Aboriginal people's possessions this side of the frontier would be the same as those of non-Aboriginal people from the same class and era. He could tell me straight up that I would not find any Aboriginal objects. The researcher's advice was kindly intentioned. He was trying to save me time and energy, diverting me from what he saw was a methodological red herring. But I was shocked. What I heard was an unintended insight into not only his thinking about notions of authenticity and material culture, but more widely, the kinds of orthodoxies that still underpin a surprising range of contemporary museum research practices. His attitude exposed, in my way of thinking, just how easy it is to follow familiar lines of inquiry. Such orthodoxies, unintentionally compounded by constant rearticulation here and in the academy, have their origins deep in the history of colonisation. Archaeologist Dennis Byrne sees the adaptation of Aboriginal equipment at the moment of contact as the moment at which Europeans began to classify Indigenous material culture. Byrne proposes that as Aborigines adapted their lifestyle and material culture under European influence, the Europeans lost interest in them. He says, the Aborigines were seen to have lost or be fast losing that quality which was the only excuse for being a native, the quality of being authentically primitive. With few exceptions, the early observers failed to attend to the process by which Aborigines were recontextualising or aboriginalising elements of European culture. That such aboriginalised objects were of so little interest to Europeans pointed to the way in which Aboriginal cultures were conceptualised as existing outside of systems of transaction and exchange, particularly in regard to technological innovation. As Byrne points out, the passivity with which Europeans saw their technology being adopted was a function not of the Aborigines' interaction with new objects, but the thinking which separated the Europeans, at least in their minds, from what they saw as primitives. This thinking, at the foundation of cross-cultural discourses for the best part of the next two centuries, played a role in the establishment of collections now housed here in this museum and museological practices throughout Australia in general. As I found out more surprisingly, it continues to play a role today. As archaeologist Rodney Harrison notes, the notion of Aboriginal history being prehistory is still shockingly pervasive, with Aboriginal people's presence before the arrival of white invaders, and this is a quote, commemorated through a heritage discourse which memorialises fossilised representations of the deep Aboriginal past, while emphasising that authentic forms of Aboriginality exist only outside of settled Australia, which, as Wesley was talking about this morning, is a complete fantasy. There was no moment of, you know, pure culture. So while the masses of ethnographic objects collected in the heyday of exploration dominate the National Historical Collection here, artefacts which offer a place to Aboriginal people within a historical narrative are, not surprisingly, few and far between. This is changing. Quite clearly, the museum has an interest in filling this gap and a duty to do so. And in order to do that, they need to find objects which hold the narratives that need telling, that need preserving. If that requires actively pursuing objects from people in the community, then that is appropriate and justified. But it's not that simple. Talking about material culture and historiographical practices from inside the borders of the museum is safe. Out in the field, the question shifts to a new paradigm where gubbers, couries, objects and history are profoundly entwined, and not necessarily in a good way. I'd like to illustrate something of this complexity by telling you a story from my own fieldwork. It was in Nowra, a town an hour or so south of Wollongong, which, as you might know, in the middle of summer, is flat and hot. Susan's 86-year-old grandmother, Auntie Mary, doesn't seem to mind. When we arrive at her new elder care unit, a development of retirement village-style accommodation out near the naval base, she is keen to take us on a tour of its features. I admire the large light switches and the button in the bathroom to call for help. My real interest, however, lies with the amazing array of black, red and yellow decorations that adorn the tiny unit, from the ornately crocheted dress on the Cupid doll in the china cabinet, to the painted cork coasters on the table, to the patchwork knee rug across the back of the couch. I try to admire them, but Auntie Mary is more interested in showing off the kitchen. It's a perfect place to segue into stories of other houses she's lived in, from the zinc shacks at Larpa where she raised her children, to the riverfront cottage at Orient Point of her own early childhood. Susan prods her in that direction, but she won't start the stories till we're settled with tea and bickies in the lounge room. I set up my camera and tape recorder while the kettle boils. I'm here to film Susan and her grandmother speaking together for an oral history project, and as usual, I'm relegated to the technological fringe, focusing lenses, testing microphone levels, framing shots. I put my headphones on and settle into the shadows as the conversation heads back towards the mission at La Perouse and the fun of diving for muttonfish and boiling the billy on the beach. We're well into the shady country of memory with a pack of barefooted kids running wild while their mother, with her long black wavy hair, dives deep into the rock pools of Botany Bay. When Susan jars us back into the present with an exclamation, "Oh, for Christ's sakes, Nan, why'd you give her that cup?" I freeze the cup midway to my mouth. I'm suddenly aware of the delicate piece of china in my hand, cream with a yellow rose pattern and gilded filigree edge. Oh, it's a lovely cup. I took it with some pleasure when Auntie Mary handed it to me, noticing that she served herself and Susan in regular thick navy blue mugs. I don't understand what the problem is. It's polite to give the good visitor the cup. Doesn't Susan think I warrant it? Auntie Mary ignores the question and we all return to the interview. As we are leaving, I reach into my bag and pull out a slab wrapped in alfoil and offer it to the old lady. She takes it and pulls back the wrapping to reveal a corner of sticky, dark, brandy-soaked fruitcake that Mum had given me for Christmas. No words are exchanged as she shoves it deep into the back of a kitchen cupboard and shepherds us towards the door. Back at the caravan where we are staying, Susan, perhaps sensing my confusion, feels the need to explain. The bone china cup is what her nan calls the Gubba cup, given to Gubbas who need to have impressed on them her good manners and her ability to maintain a properly functioning household. The tradition of the Gubba cup stems from the mission days when the manager, or perhaps his wife, would do a weekly house inspection. Blankets were lifted to examine the condition of the sheets, a gloved finger run across surfaces to check for dust, and cupboards open to check for food. During the weekly inspection, a cup of tea would be offered to the inspector in the Gubba cup. This polite ritual of tea and chat was in reality a game of high stakes. If the mission manager felt you were not up to scratch, an unfavourable report could be made to the welfare and a review of whether your children might need to be taken into care could ensue. Suddenly, irreversibly, I am in the frame. I've walked into shot and found myself cast as a central character. I am the Gubba. I constitute the other half of the story. I am the antagonist around which the action is generated, the mission manager's wife, the school headmistress, the baby's home matron, the missionary, the Gubba historian. On our return the next day, Auntie Mary tells me that she had a slice of fruitcake with her Milo before bed. It was very nice. I confess that my mum had made it. She nods and seems to be a little warmer. As I'm setting up the gear while the tea is being made, I look at the tiny unit through new eyes, Gubba eyes. The tender objects of family and identity crowd the cabinet, coffee table and walls. Posed studio photos of the children and grandchildren. The handmade decorations in team colours. Gold-rimmed sherry glasses holding posies of dried flowers. As she hands me a cup of tea, I notice I've been upgraded to a navy blue mug by virtue of Susan's intervention and Mum's Christmas cake. But it's too late. I have been told the truth. I am the Gubba. Someone has to be, and it's not like we can pretend they don't exist. The truth of that constellation is all around us. The huge family photo that takes up almost the entire wall above the couch tells the story. Yvonne, Susan's mother, smiling out from the far left, was taken into care, as was Susan in her turn. Dan, the oldest boy, leaning on his mother's shoulder and eyeballing the lens, famously made a record in jail, the first ever inmate to do so. Each of the seven of them have their story. Husbands, wives, children, siblings and parents all came up against the Gubba in one way or another. That's just the way it is. With tea made and Bickies eaten, we get back to the stories. Her conversation is dotted with references to them Gubbas, after which she looks over at me and adds, well, not you, but. When it's time to go, she kisses me on the cheek and invites me back any time. But I've already been warned off by her eldest daughter, Pam. It seems other Gubbas from other universities had been there before me and had misbehaved, writing her mother's stories into unsanctioned works. When we arrive back in Sydney, I immediately hand the master tapes to Susan. Pam is scary. The story of the Gubba cup illustrates a number of things. Firstly, and most importantly, that there is an anxiety that's inevitable when working in this domain for us Gubbas. I'm part of the history of collecting that needs to be consciously acknowledged, particularly when working on a project that has substantial links to a museum. And that's not to say that those links are entirely problematic. Being seen and heard by an outsider, especially one with institutional connections, can sometimes be an affirming moment for those who have struggled to preserve a marginalised history and also who don't have community affiliations. And besides, I might be called a Gubba, but I don't have to act like one. Nevertheless, the history between us cannot be denied, and that history is constellated by my presence. Secondly, it must be said, Aboriginal objects that hold important historical narratives, such as the Gubba Cup, have a further difficulty in coming to light. Not only are they not widely seen as Aboriginal by outsiders, but they may also not be seen as important by their custodians or owners. While museums have been obsessed with the ethnographic, Aboriginal people have continued to circulate objects within an entirely different economy of exchange. Resources are reimagined into different uses. Useful things are redistributed amongst friends and family constantly. And there's nothing to say that that particular Gubba cup is of any heritage value. It may have been bought in the local op shop or at last year's Meyer sale. And thirdly, there may also be a shame associated with poor circumstances in the past, as well as memories that people would rather not have dredged up. Renowned curator Elaine Human-Gurion, in her work establishing the Smithsonian Institution's Museum of the American Indian, found that often the people in the lowest economic strata could hardly wait to exchange their objects for those that were more valued, giving no thought at the time to the preservation of their discarded material. So it goes for most people during their most impoverished historical periods. By marking the National Museum of Australia as its centenary of federation flagship, the government openly acknowledged the role of cultural institutions in society, knowing as it does that museums, historic sites, and other institutions of memory are the tangible evidence of the spirit of a civilised society. Part of the responsibility of such a civilised society is to find the means to represent the diversity of its people. It's no longer enough to follow the well-worn grooves of essentialist discourses that are still shockingly present in the study of Indigenous material culture. Yet to move away from them is not easy either. This is a conversation that museums are having more frequently, both inside and outside its boundaries, and it's a conversation that will continue for some time yet. Thank you.
Thanks, Christine. And for those of you who don't know, we've got the archetypal Gubba Cup here. This is Captain Cook's Gubba Cup. So, please come.
First, as a comment.
Please do.
In response to Christine. I found out something here when I was young. My mother had a thing. Whenever somebody in the family would die, only if she was offered it, the closer members of the family to that person, that relative that died, said, "Would you like something of, our mother or your auntie or whatever?" And she'd always say, "Oh, I'd like a teacup and a saucer, please." And I remember my mum's auntie Mary, who was the only member of my grandmother's family that I ever remembered, because my grandmother was dead long before I was born, so she only had one sister that I remembered. And I remember my mum did get a... She really wanted a piano, but she didn't ask for that. She just, "I'll have a cup of tea and a saucer."
I just want to make a comment about... In 1992, I travelled to Buenos Aires and had an exhibition with Bunda Marica at La Recoleta Cultural Exchange. And we were getting ready for the opening, and I don't know what you'd call them, attendants or something for the Australian Embassy, came trundling in with these, push trolleys, and they had all these funeral coffins. And they were going to decorate the space. And I said, "Excuse me, can you get those coffins out of this room immediately?" And they said, "We don't know what they are. There's hundreds of them down in the basement in the Australian Embassy. We just thought we'd get them out because we thought it would make it look a bit more Aboriginal." And as they were rolling them out, all the bones came out. And I said to them, absolutely, the hair, everything. And I just freaked out. Of course I freaked out because I was a long way from home. And I was scared and I knew that I'd seen it. I didn't touch anything or whatever. But, of course, it destroyed my entire time. There was there for 2 weeks. And when I was coming home, we came back via New Zealand. And we got what they call it, stalled. Our Boeing stalled at Rio Gajegas, which is at the bottom of the Antarctic before you fly over to New Zealand. We had to wait 8.5 hours in an airport hangar for a starter motor to come in from Buenos Aires. We then were Aerolíneas Argentina at this time, and everyone was just shattered because it was like, we all wanted to get home. We had 9 hours waiting there and this. And we just thought, I've bought this. This curse has been brought on because I went there and I exhibited. I'm going to die. And so when we transferred to Qantas, they opened up, all the Qantas attendants opened up all the bar. Everyone was running around kissing each other. And when we got into New Zealand, a woman died, had a heart attack. It was the most horrendous thing I've ever did. But I did do a 3-metre by 4-metre painting called Lost in... A Journey in Colour, which was my death. I actually painted my death. And in it, I painted where I'd been, which was Buenos Aires, meant nothing to me, but what I had in the other hand was my Aboriginal world, which meant everything, and I was falling down out of the sky. I left two small children. I thought I was going to die. The inappropriateness of not a proper registrar of Aboriginal claims, of Aboriginal parts, of Aboriginal body parts, of human remains, of objects, should be an absolute, you know, moment in this country's history to retrieve all of that, to make a proper audit and return it, which they do in little bits and pieces. But at the end of the day, that really buggered up, you know, my story over there and made me feel very uneasy. And I bet you there's been nothing done about it. I bet you there's no registration of that gear at the Australian Embassy. I bet you there's nothing. So there's a lot of scary things out there.
That's just a comment, really.
The back here.
I'm just asking about the before the big rush starts. I'll get in before everybody. And just asking about the like the National Museum here in Canberra has, like you're saying, it's got the main collection for Indigenous artefacts. Is there any way that those artefacts can be interpreted by Indigenous people, or because a lot of those artefacts aren't. I have worked here before, but I was wondering about whether people are getting the right training to interpret those artefacts, or should it be? I want to ask Michael and the rest of the group, you know, where they sit on whether Indigenous people should be the only people interpreting those artefacts, or can it be just about anybody?
I think you're never going to stop non-Aboriginal people from writing history books and interpreting Aboriginal culture. You're never going to stop that. But the most important thing is that we've got to do a better job than them, really. That's my... We've got to do a better job than non-Aboriginal people so that we can take over. But you can't, you know, it's like the argument of stopping non-Aboriginal manufacturers of Aboriginal, you know, of cheap boomerangs and tourist material. You're never going to stop them from producing, you know, made in China boomerangs. The market forces are there to keep that alive. But somehow, I think, yeah, people in the cultural heritage industry have to support and promote and educate the community that they shouldn't be buying that stuff. You know, there's no legislation's not going to stop it. You somehow have to educate the community, educate the market, compete with them.
I just wanted to say, you say that you're never going to stop people, say, manufacturing Aboriginal artefacts or something like that. They must. What do they sell them at? If I'm a non-Aboriginal person and I make, say, boomerangs and I sell them, well, in Sydney, I see planes pick up foreign people from the airport and bring them down to the shops where they're selling Aboriginal artefacts, and they're made in factories by some of our migrants. Mm. You know, why don't the authorities do something about it? It must be against the law. It must be something they can do.
Well, my comment was, yes, I agree, it's wrong. And I agree, it should be against the law, but I don't think the solution is through law. It's just doing a better job and convincing people not to buy that rubbish. And I know it's not going to be easy, but I just don't think you can legislate again. I just don't. I mean, so many people have tried. I mean, Bronwyn, you've had a lot to do with copyright, and yeah.
Yeah. Can I buy that Aboriginal artefact and say it was a boomerang? Mm. And I asked you what tribe it come from, where it come from, and you gave me all that in writing.
Yeah.
Man, you've told me a lot of hogwash. You know, surely I got some comeback. I don't know. I think it's something that big time lawyers need to look at and do something about it.
I think Bronwyn, yeah.
I think the problem is it's a moral question, because at the end of the day, if you're ripping off another culture to make yourself, you know. I mean, it's like they get stuff done in Bali and Indonesia and they bring it back here. At the end of the day, Foreign Affairs should be stopping all of that stuff from coming in. That would be a procedural thing that governments could do. But My biggest degree in being involved in copyright now for almost 15 years since the inception of ARMA is really the fact that we need to self-educate. We need to know the provisions of this, like, mammoth superstructure called copyright, which is actually a non-Aboriginal structure. And at the end of the day, what it does is it gives us 70 years plus after our death the use of copyright to our family. Now, it won't accept communal ownership because that's not their structure. But we've got to fight for legislation which will adapt and change copyright to fit into more of a group ownership thing, which they've been stalling for years on because they just don't want that. At the end of the day, it's a moral issue and it's got to do with moral rights. And that's where the arguments before with Stephen and yourself are really saying that we need non-Aboriginal people to come in and help us, because at the end of the day, my agent's a QC in copyright. So, you know, when I go to do... What he's done is he's taught me how to do all of my contracts. I don't even go to him anymore because I know all the moral rights, I know the tenants, I know the clauses, and he's taught me that. So why can't every Aboriginal person in this country stop copying other Aboriginal people doing dots to validate a tourist market, which at the end of the day is debilitating our work and stopping us from going forward? And we should be working our way through the structures of ownership of cultural material. And that's a personal responsibility of every Aboriginal person in this country to learn that.
And it's such a
cultural ownership of property means your own and your family's. And then you go into the wider field. But that's, like, I don't think you can legislate to change it, because obviously they're just going to keep ignoring us. And you can't go out and bash everyone in Darling Harbour just because they're peddling, you know, black stuff that's not black. You know, I would have loved to have been a thug in another life, but it ain't going to happen.
But I think it's across the board with even Christine's talk of picking something as mundane as a teacup and then educating everybody about how important that teacup is in Aboriginal culture.
Because,
it's,
you know...
Just, yeah, that's our job.
Part of my point is that, you know, tourists who go to Darling Harbour might have come to a museum and seen boomerangs in a case in the section called Aboriginal, you know, and so that this place telling stories of what Aboriginality is has a role to play in that end of the tourist art market, and it also has a role to play in the fine art market where the really big money is.
There's two questions. The first, and it's Christine, and it's also regarding Phil's question that he asked earlier, which is how is it that Indigenous people are... How is objects that are Indigenous in the NHC being interpreted in the museum, and is that interpretation done by Indigenous people? And the other part that I want to talk about was, I've had discussions with you before, Christine, which I think are really interesting, about objects in urban Indigenous culture, contemporary objects, which talk about that historical experience, such as the teacup, and how you actually, when you went out into the community that you're working with and actually look for stuff to put into a museum to represent that culture and of those people, and what you actually found, you know, could be used. Can you talk about that a bit more?
Yeah. What happened was, you know, I went... I'll tell this really quickly. Went out to the community, said, right, I'm working on this project from the National Museum and also from the university, la, la, la. Look, you know, in museums we tell stories using objects, and that's really cool, and you guys have all been there and seen how well that works. And so what do you guys have that tells your stories? You know, we're interested because we're a modern museum, you know, and we're not interested in repeating those old kind of methodologies. We want to engage with you guys. And they went, oh, well, we don't really collect stuff and we're not that interested in your question, so what's your next one? And so that was a really interesting moment where, you know, the question and the idea of the research, the conception of it, actually didn't match the reality of people's interests out in the field. They were really interested in history, they just weren't interested in telling it in the ways that museums tell it. And that, but they are interested in being represented, particularly in the national institution, which this is. So there is a hole there. How do you fill it? It's a creative question, and it's got to be through a conversation.
We have to get smarter at how we do it.
We have to get smarter and more engaged with each other, you know.
Over the side.
Sorry, I don't want to cut across this discussion if it wants to go on.
I'll ask my question and you can see whether you want to take it up. I was interested in asking Peter's question at the end of his presentation about whether or not that set of records in the New South Wales Archives Office that documents the taking away of the children should in fact be closed, absolutely, or if people here would have any views on whether they should be closed, they should be open under particular circumstances. To close off that whole story seems terrible. And there are, of course, many terrible stories sitting in archives in many places and various protocols that have been developed to enable a sensitive and very careful access to those records that protect privacy. I don't know if people would have any comments.
Peter?
I was so upset with that when you read that story that I'm still very choked up. And I think that just from my viewpoint and my experiences alone, that you could have a whole conference just on that one topic, and you should have this place packed out with people that care, because all of the people that are here this afternoon late really care. We're all committed that are here, especially the white fellas. We wouldn't be here. But we should debate that another time for several hours, in my opinion.
We'll go back to Philip.
Just the second part. Oh, look, I know it's a very controversial thing to have non-Indigenous people interpreting Aboriginal artefacts, and I know a lot of people don't know much about it because it's an area that hasn't been talked about much. It's been taboo. It's an area that I know a lot of non-Indigenous people don't want to touch it because it's the fundamentals of the artefacts, you know, because it's telling the story. So, but I do feel that the Aboriginal people do need to be able to tell that story. And so I was just wondering if any of the group here could give me a lead on where do you, like people like myself, if I want to go and learn about interpreting Aboriginal art or Australian Indigenous artefacts, you know, where's the place to go? Is there a university or somewhere where you can go and learn about that?
All I can say is I'm a bit idealistic. I went to university, started in 1987, wanting to learn about Aboriginal culture. And I got there and soon found out my lecturers didn't know much about Aboriginal culture. Mm. And I was a bit disappointed in what they were teaching me. I was learning all about South America, North America, Papua New Guinea. But eventually I figured out that I was there to learn how to learn, not to learn about Aborigines. Mm. And then my real learning started once I had those skills. And it also started when I was a kid. It started, you know, it started from the day you're born, but you use those skills that you learn at university, and you don't have to, and I'm not saying you have to go to university to articulate yourself and talk about Aboriginal culture, not at all, but it does help, especially if you want to secure a career and earn a living from it, I guess, and to be able to do it and to be invited to forums like this and articulate yourself so that people invite you back to another forum.
And I think at the museum here, we're really conscious that there are a lot of white staff, and apart from looking for more black people to work for us, with us, the idea is that we go to communities and we talk and we learn and they interpret through us. So I think we... Last question, and then we'll go to Peter, who's going to give us a summation of the day. So, Joe.
Hi. My question has to do with something Michael said, but it's something that I'd like a response from all three of you if there's time. You said there's always going to be non-Indigenous people interpreting Indigenous culture, and you might have been talking only in the context of museums and artefacts, but the idea about that authority to interpret or lack of authority to interpret Indigenous culture is something that spans a lot of disciplines, and there's a lot of people working in Indigenous area who aren't Indigenous, and I was just wondering about the question of authority and you've all coming at it from different areas. I'd like to know what you think about that.
Well, I definitely wasn't just talking about history or museums. I mean, you're never going to stop the press writing and broadcasting horrible things about Aboriginal communities. That's a tough one, you know. They're going to keep on doing it. So I was talking broad. That's why I went from boomerangs to museums to, you know, to everything. Yeah, no. School teachers for starters.
Can I just make a quick response to that? You know, I see, you know, what I'm trying to do is to forge something that's neither Aboriginal history or not Aboriginal history. You know, the story I told today was my story, and it's the story of a white person. So it wasn't an Aboriginal story, and I have the authority to tell that story because it was about myself. So what I'm trying to do is find a way to have a conversation, you know, that's inclusive, where we can participate in an outcome that we decide together.
I mean, how can every child, as mentioned a few times today, you know, education has to start with the primary school children. Well, how are the primary school children going to learn about Aboriginal culture if the majority of teachers that were non-Aboriginal can't teach it?
One of the most basic premises, I think, on learning about... the question you asked about learning, how does someone learn about Aboriginal artefacts, I think is how you put it. You know, if, for example, I mean, it's as basic as asking the people whose artefacts they are. It's almost that, and the same with art. Like if you, for example, this is a pragmatic answer, but if you sort of did what Michael was saying and you learn how to learn, which whether you do it through a university or TAFE or through whatever, a process, if there's a certain kind of... process, but then to get down to the particularities, you got an internship or a job or something out of Mitchell's store, for example, and you came across a whole bunch of artefacts, and you'd then find out whose they were, and then you'd go and talk to the people about that, or locate the people whose artefacts they are. It's sort of that simple, but that hard. And the same with art. It's really, if you were found yourself in a position where you were to interpret art, you again would find out whose art it was, whose people's art it is, or that kind of process. And you just, it's really that simple in a way. No one can teach you that. It's really a practitioner's process. But there's just a principle of asking those who have the right to give an answer.
Better make this quick. We're all pretty talked out, I think. So, very briefly, this is my take on it, I think. You know, when first... Aboriginal children came to Governor Macquarie's school in 1814. Half of them were part descent kids. But nobody said, hey, we don't want those kids in here because they're not Aboriginal, did they? And, of course, some generations were never told, no, you come from an urban environment, you're not Aboriginal, we don't want you here, thank you. You think of the 1937 conference, you know, that one, the big one that put assimilation in place, except for what they called people of the full descent. They weren't going to be assimilated. What they really meant, those legislators in 1937, were people in Arnhem Land. They didn't say that, but that's really what they meant, though. The big Arnhem Land reserves. You think what the other big divisions have been. Aboriginal people, as you know far better than me, have been afflicted by this quarter caste, half caste, octoroon, quadroon thing, yeah? Dividing people up all the time. That's yet another division, as Wes pointed out, that's been foisted upon us, he said. Think of the young graduates. The first graduates in the 1960s going out in their communities, and they were told, some of them by their own people, but certainly by white fellas, you can't speak for us because you've got a degree. You're not Aboriginal either. Yeah? The big go in the 60s was traditional, non-traditional. That's how the money was divided up when the NACC started in the 70s. That was the same kind of thing. Traditional, non-traditional. Then in the 1980s, you had a new thing, which was arguing about whether people on reserves, the small reserves, not the Arnhem Land ones, the ones around here, from Yass or somewhere, whether the people there were really Aborigines or not. You think, well, maybe it didn't matter too much because that's something that anthropologists argued about. So I think, and then the latest one now, of course, is urban or traditional or remote, rather, or regional. And it really matters now, unfortunately. Now, in some ways, everybody here has been today said, of course we're bloody urban. What do you think we are? In some ways, there's no dispute about it. Of course it is. What's the big deal? Who's asking the questions? It doesn't matter. Everybody's been convinced of that. Except, of course, we can say, well, in a way, it does matter. in a way that it didn't. When the anthropologists argued about reserve Aborigines, who cares, doesn't matter. But of course now, as we've heard from time and time again, it really does matter. And it matters more, not just all the wonderful things that are coming from urban culture and the schools at Inala and La Perouse and the museums setting up and the films and the literature and all that stuff that's coming. That's wonderful, but it doesn't solve the problem of the government prejudice against urban Aboriginal people, yeah? And we've been coming at that from different directions all day. There's a real prejudice against it. I think it's a little bit like that old 1937 conference, which privileges people living as far away as possible. Now, why is that? One, I think it's the great lure of the exotic. Now, I'm not saying anything against those doctors and people who are going out to help sexual assault victims in remote communities. Yeah, I'm sure they're wonderful people. But how many would you have got if we said we go to Picton now? We've been in such a rush of people. There's still a lure of the exotic, isn't there? We've seen it so much in the old Institute of Aboriginal Studies. They used to give all their grants in the 60s and 70s and 80s to remote regions. Why? Because the people down here, well, they didn't really count. And as Christine said, the number of artefacts from southern Aboriginal Australia collected by the museum here in the last 30 years is minute compared to the ones from the north. Sometimes conscious prejudice, sometimes unconscious. Now, I think we've still got to fight, and that's what we didn't really come to grips with. We just sort of thought about it during the day. How to fight against this major prejudice that governments have. One, because it's exotic, and two, because you're really encouraging Aboriginality in the cities by giving proportionate funding to Aboriginal people who do live in this 70%. You know, that's the argument still. We've got to fight against it in some way. And we got three quarters of the way to there, I think, but that's still to be resolved maybe in another conference. How do you fight against this prejudice? A prejudice, yeah. Bloody hell. You go out there and have a look. What's that vast expanse of concrete out there? What's this thing here? This empty space here. It's the Garden of Australian Dreams. Cold and windy in winter. In summer, as hot as a hobs of hell, like a school playground. Have a look at there. What's this written down here? Bloody hell. Warramunga. Arunta, Walpri. What are they doing here? Why is the Northern Territory and Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory suddenly the Garden of Australian Dreams? Why is this the centre of Australia? Who said that was? It'd be nice to think it was those American curators who did it, who just bought the current thing. Maybe it was a bit more than that. The government wants to get that emphasis off there, eh? It's all around us. It's in this museum. Go and look in that thing out there, you'll see it. Okay, we've got things to do still in the future. Now, my last job, I haven't been asked to do it, but what a fantastic conference. Thank you, organisers. I'm not sure it was Margot or Barb together, or whose was it? Whose idea was it? Who organised it? The Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Program. The Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Program did it. It's a privilege for me to be here, and I think that it was just a terrific day. So, whether Margaret wants to say a last few words, I don't know. But anyway, I thought it was really wonderful. Thanks for being here, everybody, and thanks, organisers.
Okay, I just have the honour of thanking people, as we do and should do. So I'd just like to... I have to say, you know, whilst I'm on the team, and immodesty may restrain me slightly, but I have to say I thought it was fantastic today, and I've heard from lots of people about this particular constellation and how there were a whole lot of things that opened up today, that blackfellas talking about blackfellas and actually opening a lid on a lot of things, which will lead, I'm sure, to the debate pursuing into the future, as many people were suggesting it should. So, and I thought a lot of that. Now, I don't go to every conference in the universe, so I can't tell whether how common it is. But the feedback from people today was really direct. It was very honest. It was very open. People felt entirely comfortable about saying what they had to say without, you know, a whole mob of people jumping down their throat and saying blackfellas aren't allowed to say that. So I think that's a huge gain, and I know I mentioned this before because I think it's worth mentioning more than once. So I'm just hoping that we can do something really valuable with the notes that come out of this, which of course we will send to the speakers involved first and then have that kind of discussion, because I just really do think there's a lot more that this shouldn't just stay here.
And everyone involved can, you know, help work out what that next thing might be. So thank you very much, speakers, those who are present and those who are not. We can pass that on, and many had to rush off to another opening in Sydney. And also a special mention, I have to make a special mention to Uncle Gordon Siren over there, who's in this context, in the urban context, is one of our elders and very much one of the pioneers of the urban Aboriginal art movement as it is known at the moment. So, I haven't seen him at lots of conferences, so I'm really pleased he made it, and to his lovely wife, Elaine Siren, who supports him to the hilt, and I'm sure vice versa. We all worked on the 70% urban exhibition, and, you know, I have to say, it sort of, I proposed this a lot of years ago, and for various reasons, some of which have been mentioned today, it was really hard to get up. It was always other priorities. It's not because of the directors. It was because of another layer of management at the time. But things have changed, and it is up, and once it got the go-ahead, it went very fast. So, and it's really important, you know, whether you think it looks fantastic or it doesn't look fantastic or whatever you think about it, I think the important thing is that we got in a museum. We've heard about the historic buyers to the north and so on, that we got up in the National Museum of Australia, an exhibition devoted to, you know, the 70% and the urban, acknowledging the importance of urban culture, whatever that is, whatever it isn't. And we found what we could find in this collection and added to it. It gave us an opportunity to buy extra stuff to sort of build up that picture of how, in various ways, it's an urban indigenous culture that's sort of expressed through visual means, one way or another, be it buttons, T-shirts, paintings, or whatever. So I'd be really interested in people who get an opportunity to look at that, you know, to give us some feedback, because it's kind of new in a way. Well, certainly is for me, because I'm, you know, my history has been mostly art galleries, where you're dealing with in some ways, a less complex range of histories. So anyway, that's all from me, and thank you very much, everybody, once again, and everybody who helped, and interested in your feedback, and you are now free to go.